And we're going to do, we'll do the same rules that we did on Sunday. If anyone at any point, you know, has a question or would like to discuss something that would not want to go recorded, just say the word. It causes posterity. People like, you know, people have requested that I, you know, record Sheeran. And I hope to update the show's website a bit and you'll maybe put up audio, get more traffic to the website and show and all that good stuff. I'm not sure it's really a rival, because YU Torah has helped certain shuls. Like, they'll actually put the YU Torah interface on the shul's website for you to, like, search audio Sheeran and whatnot. I mean, I actually uploaded Sundays on my own personal podcast, but there's no reason why it can't be duplicated. And also, people have requested it. And, you know, the truth is, we have some really great conversations here and might jog someone's, you know, someone's head and get through stuff. So, at any rate, our first source that we just had here, you know, spoke about is, you know, Gemara in Sanhedrin Yudzayin that says you need to be a Baal Keshefin to be on the Sanhedrin. So we're going to, you know, discuss that a little bit more of, you know, if you're going to rule on what the voters are, you have to know what a voter's are is. Right? Very simple.
Can I go one quick second on that?
Sure.
I think it was Potter Stewart who, when asked about what it had to define pornography, said,
I know when I see it. Yeah.
Isn't there an I know it when I see it factor in something like this?
I think that's how people operate, but in practice, I think that's what happens. I don't think that that's accurate, though. Like, you know, because when I start getting a lot of questions about Buddhism and yoga, right? Instead of like saying, well, this looks like a Bodhisattva, actually I have to spend the time and do the research and saying, well, what's Buddhism? What are the different traditions? And you're yes, it might appear to it superficially, but that might not necessarily be what's going on behind the scenes. Like, you just sit, you know, see people sitting in a room, you know, in a lotus position, not talking, not moving. What is that? How are you supposed to know?
Okay.
All right. Like, the laws of Avodah Zarah are, like, incredibly, you know, extensive. And we're clearly not going to cover all of them or even come close to, you know, getting through this particular topic. But, again, enough to scratch the surface. So, first, some of the main restrictions. George?
It is a part of the commandment to destroy idolatry, its tools, and whoever creates for its purpose. And Israel, there is a commandment to chase after it until it is eradicated from our land. But outside of Israel, we have no commandment to chase after it. But rather, any place which we can conquer, we destroy all idolatry, which is idol worshiping, and its tools and its offerings, and anything made for it is forbidden to derive benefit from it. And whoever does so is lashed twice for violating two prohibitions.
Right, so this is Rambam's Laws of Avodah Kohatim 7, 1, and 2. For the most part, I try to avoid using the term idolatry for Avodah Kohatim, which literally means, anyone?
Worship of the stars.
Yeah, so it really extends to, you know, almost any sort of thing. Avodah Kohatim sometimes was a euphemism, used so that no individual, someone from another religion would say, oh, you're talking about it. He says, no, we're just talking about the people who worship, you know, the sun or certain constellations. It's probably said it to a lot more. So, yeah, any thoughts on this?
Would that be astrology as well?
Well, astrology is a little bit different in terms of, like, the motto. We gave a whole sheer on that, but, you know, it's a little complicated.
Well, our understanding of it is, but for other people, it's not. I mean, for Romans and Greeks and other ancient European religions, the zodiac and the cycle of the month and everything played a big role in the events that take place among people.
Yeah, but that might not come under the category of worship as much as science. It can go either way. It gets a little complicated with the certainly if you pray to the constellations, like but a few people have seen Battlestar Galactica, right? So there, the constellations were actually the deities, you know, that they prayed to. That was the whole point of polytheism and monotheism, being going on. But like, there's a difference between saying that and assuming, well, here's scientifically how the world works. And you have the big discussion about if there's Mazal Yisrael or ain't Mazal Yisrael, and are we under the constellations, not under the constellations, and all that. So I think if you're talking about worshiping them, certainly that's a problem. If you're talking about assuming this is how nature works and you're using it as a buzzword for nature, I think you have some sources in the sages that might lead you in that direction. But I think you're talking about specifically about Avodah, like you're actually like, you know, hardcore worshiping it. So, based on this, like, what would you say today about, I don't know, religious fundamentalism and, you know, pluralism and tolerance, especially in Israel and outside?
Religious pluralism and tolerance?
Yeah.
We have that in Israel?
Well, I mean, well, the truth is, in a sense, we do have it in Israel. Well, there are churches in Israel.
Yeah.
Right.
But there have always been churches in Israel.
So according to Rambam, Shrevi says that there's actually a positive commandment to destroy all places of idolatry in Israel. Outside of Israel, not so much.
But still a positive commandment, so far. It's just kind of surprising that, like, you don't see more, like, sovereigns, like, crossing over the bridge.
Ah. Right, so there is a principle of
fountains don't like it.
Well, I mean, there's a principle of a bitul aseh, or sheva al tata is a better way of putting it. It's what discretion is the better part of valor. We did a source here from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He said, "Don't be so quick to tear down, you know, the altars of, you know, the non-Jews, lest you be forced to rebuild them again." So, you know, it's one thing. Yes, assuming we had complete and total control over everything political, maybe, you know, say, okay, fine, let's tear down the churches, but we don't. And you know, there sort of is, in a weird way, that greater good thing. Yeah. Any thoughts? And this is still pretty harsh language here. So you think even outside of Israel, you know, you're not, you know, if you can, do it. Otherwise, you don't have the same obligation. And the other thing that's important to consider here is you can't derive benefit from idolatry. I'm going to explain a little bit in detail what that means. So even if you don't actually get up and, you know, burn down the churches, you're still not allowed to derive benefit from idolatry.
We've seen in the Gemara where they go out of their way to give you the extreme case to prove a point.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So let's say you're the guy with the sledgehammer concession next door to the Avodah Zarah store.
Yeah.
Are you deriving benefit from Avodah Zarah?
In which way?
You set up a concession to sell sledgehammers and say, here, these two.
Well, because you're not really... Well, no. What it means is, like, if there was something that associated with a Avodah Zarah, and you will...
Some church funded the first Aliyah.
Nefesh for Nefesh.
Yeah,
I guess.
Funded by a church?
Not sure.
Evangelicals. It's actually kind of amusing.
Nefesh for Nefesh.
According... To explain why the belief amongst this group, I don't know if it's all evangelicals, but this group was that in order for the rapture to come, the majority of Jews need to be in Israel. So it's in their best interest for the Jews to be there. And I believe they asked the head of the ADL, you know, what do you think about this? Like, they're paying you know, to move to Israel. And the first few years of Nefesh B'Nefesh, they actually paid people money to make Aliyah. Nefesh B'Nefesh still exists. It's like a health organization, but they don't give you money anymore. My sister and brother-in-law on the first flight, they got some money from them.
Wow.
Yeah.
You don't get stipends anymore?
Not that I know of.
You get free shipping.
Oh, they do?
But you get a stipend when you make Aliyah even without.
Oh, could be. This was a separate bonus thing. So anyway, the funny thing was when they asked him, you know, well, why are you, you know, doing this? Because they only want you in Israel because ultimately Jesus was going to come. There's going to be the rapture and it's going to be good for the Jews.
Right.
And the response was, well, for the part, you know, as long as we are on the same page, we'll agree with each other. And for the other side, you know, we won't. But it is an interesting question of, you know, is that really considered deriving benefit from Avodah Zarah versus, you know, because if you've got a church that's actually helping support, you know, this endeavor, are you allowed to, you know, have a joint function and, you know, participate with the money, I think?
Well, it depends on how Avodah Zarah is defined.
It also depends on what you mean by a voter. We'll see a couple of examples down here. Yeah.
The Avodas Kochavim. Kochavim is in the plural. Are they intending to mean polytheism as opposed to Kochav?
No, I don't think that's what I mean. I think it's more of a generic catch-all term for. I mean, you do think of Avodah Zarah as opposed to Avodah Zarah.
Just trying to look at the ground.
Yeah, yeah, that's fine. Ephraim, got some more restrictions in number three that have come up a bit.
It's forbidden to make artistic images, either not for purposes of worship, and this provision is only for making the image of man alone, be it by wood, cement, or stone. It is only when the image is protruded, and if it is engraved, it is permitted.
So, why does you want to be allowed to be a sculptor?
A sculptor of statues of people.
Yeah, well, that's what sculpture usually is. Sculptures of people, yeah.
And you could do a sculpture of roots or animals.
According to this, yeah. To Nima, number four. This gets into a little bit of. So, this actually helps answer source number four, Rambam Bodo Kokobim 9.1, helps with Jacob's question about, to what extent he dealt with the money thing. To Nima?
3 days before an idolatrous holiday, it is forbidden to take from them or to sell something less than to loan to them, to borrow to repay or to be repaid, either by contract or collateral. But a loan done orally may be repaid because you are saving yourself from them, and it is permissible to sell something which will not endure, such as vegetables or cooked food, until the day of their holidays. When was this said? In Israel, the outside is only forbidden on the day of their festival.
So in addition to, I put in these two sources because one, one question which we'll see in a little bit has to deal with taking certain the artistic side of Avodah Zarah, whereas in source number three, which is the Avodah Kochavim 3:10, you're not allowed to make certain things yourself because of the, it looks like it could be considered Avodah Zarah. We'll see about the non-Jews if they make certain sculptures. In this context here, it refers to your specific actions are limited. In source number four, in terms of our interactions with non-Jews, letter of the halacha, days before the holiday, you're not supposed to interact with them in a way that would facilitate or make them happier for the days of their holiday. Notice something else that in this halacha that we saw earlier in the Rambam, a very important distinction.
In Israel and outside?
Yeah, in Israel and outside of Israel. Seems to be stricter in Israel, though as an outside of Israel, you just can't do stuff on that day. In Israel, you have a 3-day waiting period. Yeah.
Are we going to discuss, are we going to source for why certain groups go back to number three, why they take a lot more lechuma and sanity and pictures or forms of course?
Not really.
Is that a source? I mean.
Well, I mean, the Rambam only forbids a certain amount. It's not uncommon for stringencies to pop up, especially in matters that are this serious. Meaning, when it comes to Avodah Zarah, the whole when you see it thing, I think one reason why people do it is to always be on the safe side. Avodah Zarah is mentioned so often in the Torah as something that we really, we're told, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. You go through Nevi'im, we keep on doing it. The Gemara is very strict about it, the Yehar Zal Yavor, so it shouldn't be surprising if additional stringencies came up afterwards because it seems like it or it's close to it. That doesn't mean it falls under either the biblical or rabbinic categories, though. All right? Now, here's where it gets really fun.
I don't understand.
Oh, sure.
From number four in the middle, but a loan and orally may be repaid because you're saving yourself.
Right. If I borrowed money, let's say from a non-Jew, and it's only an oral contract, right, then there's something that he's holding over my head, in a way, or at least it seems to put you in a more tenuous situation. And when you repay the loan, you're sort of like freeing yourself from, being under his thumb there. Whereas if it's just a matter of contract stuff, there's a certain degree of protection that you have.
Tony Soprano will leave you alone.
Right. Yeah. Take number five. This is to explain number five and why this is really important. This is a snippet from the base of the Chira of the Me'iri. Me'iri medieval commentator lived in Provence, and he wrote commentary on all of Shas. It's actually a very easy readable commentary amongst, you know, from the Rishon, and one of the clearer ones you're going to find. However, he's known, at least in this context, it is attributed to him the opinion that Christianity is not Avodah Zarah. We'll see a source here that kind of contradicts that assumption, and another one that might be along with it. What Meiri actually holds is somewhat of a matter of a dispute. If anyone is interested, there's an article from the God Journal from a couple of years ago by Moshe Halbertal, where he also like puts in footnotes and has his own spin on how to read Meiri. The reason why I put it in here is because for this discussion, it's very important. Very few people have seen him inside, and we're going to see now why it's important to see him inside. Go ahead. This is a commentary to page 8A from,
Can I ask a quick question about
sure.
before?
Yeah.
So a mortgage banker who knows that his customer of the moment is about to buy his son and daughter-in-law house for Christmas isn't allowed to sell them the mortgage, according to this?
In Israel.
Well, it would, in Israel probably certainly a lot different than in America. I mean, in America, you would talk about like the actual closing on the holiday, and pretty much any holiday banks are going to be closed anyway.
No, 3 days before he closes.
That's only in Israel, right? So if you're talking about like in Israel, like would you have to like act differently if you're a bank? I don't know, it could be a hetz in the fear there too. I mean, look, there are people who say you can't rent your place to, you know, Arabs, so kal vachomer, you shouldn't sell it to them either. I'll leave that up to, that was being facetious and sarcastic, I know you know that, but like if anyone's listening, you understand? No. Yeah, strike that from the record. Well, sarcasm doesn't always come out well on these things, so I need to throw in disclaimers and I don't have subtitles. Only joking. Yeah, too much work. Dana. Number 5. This is Meiri. His commentary to Avodah Zarah on Daf Chet. The truth is, if you really want to know the full opinion of Meiri, there's no short solution other than to read through the entire Meiri on Avodah Zarah. And you'll see why when I quote the excerpts. Go.
Can I try the Hebrew?
Sure.
Okay. The Darash Azot Ha'uma Han... Zahuba? Han... What?
Nitzaria.
Nitzaria. Oh, the Christian. Hey, Christian. Hello. Ha'ochim achar emunat yeshu. Apatisha dachos tehen mishonos kulam obdei avodah zarah. And know that in this Christian nation where they follow after Jesus, even though their laws are different, they're all idolaters. Ve'edeihem kulam asurim, and acceptable, they're all prohibited. The Rari Linhog Imahem Bachal HaTorah Masha
Yinaheg
Im Ode Avodah Zarah. And their festivals are all prohibited, and it's proper to act among them with all of the Torah as appropriate for acting among worshippers of Avodah Zarah.
And according to here so far, he seems to take followers of Jesus as as coming under this halachic category. Here's where it gets really fun.
The Yom Rishon Michlal a Dehem Shel Goyim L'sichas Aser
L'Lafeit
the L'Lafeit in Mi She Ya'amin.
Oh God, bad translation on my part, sorry.
Mi She Ya'amin B'Dat Yeshu the Echad, the Shabbos.
Yeah.
Klal.
The Shindavar.
Aval Yinaheg Imahem. The Echad, the Shabbos. Mashi Nahegim Ode Avodazar B'Yom Edom.
Yeah.
And Sunday is considered one of the holy days to the non Jews, and therefore it's forbidden to.
Give and take. Forgot what I wrote there. Yeah, stupid translation.
Mary is not the right.
No, I don't.
Do business.
Yeah,
forbidden to do business or to give to one who believes in the law of Jesus on Sunday.
Believes in the law of Jesus on Sunday. Little stone when I read this, but yeah, fine.
Believes in the law of Jesus anytime. Okay, fine. Forbidden to do business with them on Sunday.
Yeah.
But rather, he should act among them as if it were any other holiday for Avodah Zarah.
So according to this snippet of the Meiri, you can't do business with non-Jews on Sunday because Sunday is their holy day. It's like Christmas. Blue laws, people, blue laws.
I don't see the pressure of like why their holy days. They're doing a Avodah Zarah every day.
It's not that there's a day that they worship on any given day, but if there's a special day dedicated to a Avodah Zarah, for let's say Catholics at least, Sunday is the day of rest. That's their holy day. So it's not necessarily a holiday that we would say is a festival exclusive, like Easter, like Christmas, right, which are clearly days of significance. He's extending it even to their Shabbat, even to their idea of the Sabbath. That's considered a holy day, and any prohibition that you would assume ought to take effect on Christmas takes effect every single Sunday.
What about Seventh Day Adventist?
Yeah, they didn't exist at the time of the area, I don't think, at least.
On Sunday, so can you do business with them on Sunday if they're Seventh Day Adventist?
That's
not their Shabbat.
Right, so then if it's not their Shabbat, then no, then you're fine.
Yeah, you're giving this an extension of benefiting from Avodah Zarah?
It's not so much even you benefiting from Avodah Zarah as much as facilitating them being worshipping Avodah Zarah.
It's a good business for you that it's hurting their Avodah Zarah, right?
It's not that it's hurting their Avodah Zarah, but if you're doing business and they're making money off of it, you're making them happier in Avodah Zarah for doing business.
Or could it be referring to a situation where maybe they're running out to get something for their service or for their dinner, like you run a grocery store and they come buy a ham from you.
Yep.
Assuming that you sell hams. That's the situation that works too.
First 325 years until the Council of Nicaea, Christians observe something as Jews do.
The Council of what?
Council of Nicaea. That's when they changed from Saturday to Sunday. They made a distinction. So what was the view of the Jewish Pharisee at that period of time?
We've been doing that on Sunday.
Huh.
Yeah. That'll take at least 3 hours to explain, at the bare minimum.
You know the story, Rabbi, about the old Jew who converts to Christianity and been an entrepreneur all his life?
Mm.
And he converts to Christianity, and he figures he should don't have good Christian business. He doesn't know what a good Christian business is. He opens up the Yellow Pages. Nothing under A, nothing under B. Under C, he finds crosses. So he opens up a little crosses store. On the first day, he calls the crosses distributor. And he says, "Hello, I would like to order 10,000 crosses, please." But the voice at the other end says, "Aha, midimandu or midoutimandu?"
Right. If this goes up, I'm going to have to edit that one out. No offense.
Come on, that's a good show.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, be a Homer.
Yeah.
True. What is that? 22 minutes. All right. Just making a mental note there. So, Yabia Omer, this is already, this is a phenomenal tshuva. This is written by Rev Avadi Yosef. I referenced it a couple of times in shul. And it's a great one in terms of the contemporary halakhic implications.
Yabia Omer is the name of the sefer?
Correct. So, Rev Avadi Yosef has two major halakhic works, both named after the same pasuk. There's Yom Yom Yabia Omer, V'Layla Layla Yechaved Da'at. So Yabia Omer is the really big book. It's like, I think he's still coming out with volumes. By big book, I mean, he really gets into the halakhic, ins and outs. Yechaved Da'at is, I forget if it's 6 or 8 volumes, and it's a transcription of his radio show. And in terms of, if you're ever interested in this, starting off learning responsa, I highly recommend the Yechaved Da'at because it's relatively easy to read. It's certainly a lot much easier Hebrew than Rav Moshe. So, little plug there. So this is Yabia Homer, where he's getting a little more in detail. And he's talking here about an incident where they would go to churches after the church. Oh, I don't even know what I was writing here. Churches after churches. You have notes in the Apocalypse. It wasn't the churches behind the curtains. On the days of their festival, to teach themselves the tunes for the high holidays, and they would rearrange from them the holy sounds in Wondrous Holy. So basically, you're talking about a case here where Chazanim would go into churches and learn their melodies so they could incorporate it for the Yom HaNoah.
Wait, isn't that what we do now?
It's not like the Beach Boys.
So are the Beach Boys considered a Avodah Zarah? Here's his answer. It says here, and it seems difficult to say that it is permissible to listen to their music while it is before Avodah Zarah, meaning when the guy's going in and hearing these tunes in the church, and you can read this in a couple of different ways, as these tunes are going on, these are liturgical tunes used for the purpose of worshiping, let's say, Jesus, assuming, you know, it's a church. And additionally, that they should enter their place of worship, for that is a clear prohibition. There's a separate law that we have, that you're not allowed to enter the place that is designated for worshiping of a Avodah Zarah. So you're talking about churches, and this comes up a lot if someone wants to check out the art of a church. You're actually not allowed to enter the sanctuary of the church itself, assuming it is from a denomination that would be classified as a Avodah Zarah. So if it would, say, be a Catholic church, you know, I would say absolutely prohibited. Anything the Protestant, you have to do some research. Well, before we get to the question, this is like worth explaining here a few bits. You know, so when you're talking about the aesthetics, you know, he's dealing with a case here of when, you know, going actually into church, the tunes are being used as that moment for Avodah Zarah. I had a friend of mine who was interested in doing the choir, and one of the pieces that they would sing was a Danish choral church piece. And she wanted to know if it was okay. Why? Because she doesn't know Danish. Right? I don't even know Danish. Danish is a language or not? My head's been all creepy today. Okay, that's a new language. Good. Yeah. So, thank you, George. Man of my own heart there. George just said the language is a piece of cake. Nicely done, George. Right, so the point is, so one, you're not singing, you're like, she has no idea what she's singing. And additionally, doing it as a performance is not the same as doing it as a matter of worship. Meaning, there's a very big difference if you play Bach, you know, on your stereo versus you do it in an organ in a church. Right? One's ritual, the other isn't. You may be able to make a distinction there or not. What do you say?
Well, there are organ recitals that take place in churches that are not part of an actual worship, but they can be perceived by the audience as worship.
Okay, so you think it has to do with the perception from other people?
Well, sure.
Well, here's the other issue. I mean, regardless, you wouldn't be allowed to play it in the church itself.
Isn't it likely that she's such a choir?
Church angels?
Pardon?
Everything that's like fun.
Hi. One second. We're back on.
Oh, of course, she's graduate City College, the Great Hall, before Christmas. They have these concerts like Ave Maria.
Yes,
it's open. And we'll load the armatures.
Yeah, sure. It also comes up a lot for graduations. I think Columbia has a graduation in the chapel. Chicago, I believe, has something in the chapel. These are all things that, you know, I'm not going to say blanket they're okay, blanket they're not okay. Like if it's really interdenominational, if it's really used specifically for a ritual purpose. Huge questions you have to ask on a case-by-case basis.
In Cornell, they have a chapel and a revolving whatever. On one side is an Alan Kodish. Revolves it around.
I've never seen that actually revolve. There's a place that friends of mine called a shul. It was a church on Sunday and a shul on Shabbat. It's on Bennett Avenue, either next door, a few doors down from where Rick Gelly lives. Like the only
shul.
I don't know, but it was a very interesting place. I knew the Reform Rabbi there one year, and one of her like big innovations was to get the sukkah built outside. So it was a fairly interesting, you know, place. But there, you know, are places like that. As far as the Buddha goes, you know, separate discussion.
Well, hang on.
Yeah. All right. So that, you know, from that perspective, right? I wanted to. It's very hard to organize stuff like this, especially when there's so much material. So in section one, I just put together, like, you know, the strictest, you know, some of the stricter elements. Section two, what are some possible exemptions? And I think, George, we saw some of these before. But take number seven. This is a Mishnah Bodhisattva 3-4. We're on page 2.
So close. Senator Vlasov put a question to Rabbi Gamliel in Akko. When the latter was bathing in the bath of Aphrodite. He said to him, "It's written in your Torah, and there shall cleave naught of a devoted thing to thine hand. Why are you bathing in the bath of Aphrodite?" He replied to him, "You may not answer question relating to the Torah in a bath. When he came out, he said to him, I did not come into her domain. She has come into mine." Nobody says the bath was made as an adornment for Aphrodite, but he says Aphrodite was made as an adornment for the bath. And another reason is, and he's talking about the statue itself.
Yeah.
Another reason is, if you were given a large sum of money, you would not enter the presence of the statue revered by you, while you were nude or had experienced seminal emission, nor would you urinate before it. But this statue, the statue of Aphrodite, stands by a sewer, and all people urinate before it. In the Torah, it is only stated, and their god, that is, what is treated as a deity is prohibited. What is not treated as a deity is permitted.
This is a huge, huge difference here, right? So you're talking about statue of Aphrodite in a bathhouse, that even though it's a statue, even though it's of a god, or goddess, I should say, it's not considered as an object of a Vodazara. It's considered either more pop culture at the time, which is, I think, how we described it in the first time around we did the source. But you're not; it's not being treated in any way as an idol or something that ought to be worshipped.
It's an adornment.
Exactly. It's a piece of decoration.
You can argue that a lot of crucifixes today are adornments in pop culture.
I'm not sure about a crucifix as much as a cross.
Okay, fine. I mean, without the guy on it.
That would be the cross.
Crucifix with the guy on it?
No, without the guy.
The crucifix, yes, actually has.
Crucifix is with the guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so, no, just fine. The cross, then, is, in many cases, you can make an argument that it's just a, it's, you know, a pop type of thing.
Possibly. I mean, he does make a point here of, it's, you know, normally you would treat a certain item associated with your divinity with a degree of respect, right, and reverence. With the statue of Aphrodite, you're clearly not. Now, posting up, say, a picture of a cross could go either way. I mean, I don't have any crosses in my house, so I don't know, and I haven't been to enough houses with crosses to know how
it is. In the net, you know, a lot of religious items, which are, you know, what your home is like, art next to other stuff.
Mm.
Say they're, you know, being used they aren't being used as a bonus art in the net.
That would be a good example. You might even extend that to the cloisters. If you walk into the cloisters, which is the museum in Fort Tryon Park, one of the first things you see is like a 40-foot tall crucifix. You know, but it's now set up more as a museum than it is. You never been?
Yeah.
Right. You know, I think it's a large. Yeah, it might be. Yeah. So I think at that point, it seems to be, this item seems to be more treated by it. Taking it a step further, Jacob. Source number 8, please. This is Yerushalmi and Shavit, 8-8.
Relation other than each within Vatra, and he saw that they, the Greeks, were pouring water to Aphrodite. He asked the Jews, "Do not the waters become forbidden?" He came and asked Rabbi Yochanan to reply, "A public object does not become prohibited through use in idol worship."
Yeah. So this is another distinction that we can make. Meaning, even if it's not a, you know, even if you don't want to say it's just purely for decorative purposes, if it's therefore, if it itself is a public matter, then it wouldn't have that same category. There was a distinction, which I didn't include here, if you had a water fountain right before a, you know, a statue, that you wouldn't be allowed to drink from it because it looks as if you're bowing to the statue. That would be an exception because of how it's perceived. But if it's something that's primarily, you know, for public works, then it's clear that it's for public works. Meaning, if you just go up and you bow to it, right, then it looks like you as an individual are doing it. Here, if it's clear that, oh, this is the masses, then it no longer has, you know, that shame of a vote that's attached to it. It's kind of interesting.
So you can still go to Rio de Janeiro with the giant 50-foot Jesus?
Well, the giant 50-foot Jesus doesn't do anything. I mean, it's just standing
there.
Yeah, but by a public thing, like, it also just stands there. I mean, it's not like you're using it for any purpose. Unlike, like, say, the water here, right, where ostensibly you'd have to eat.
What do they mean, pouring water to after that? Isn't that an act of worship?
I guess, but, you know, water is still water. Like, I mean, I don't know if stuff was recycled. Like, let's say there was a fountain. You know, there was a public fountain and stuff. I mean, would you be able to use it? I don't know. It's a good question. Have to look into that more.
Would,
to see exactly,
would you be allowed to do the hike up?
Sure was. Yeah. It's a good point. Mm.
A public object does not become prohibited through use in idol worship.
Yeah. Well, look at it this way. You've got the Empire State Building, right? Let's consider that a public space. Or, Statue of Liberty. There's a good one. Right? Nice public space.
Double whammy.
Right? The statue. Let's say someone prays to the Statue of Liberty. Does that make it a vote of Zara? No. Right? In a sense, in order for someone to become a vote of Zara, it has to be consecrated by, let's say, some body or some purpose that, you know, could actually say this is a vote of Zara. If it's clearly a public matter, like, it might be a little bit more difficult in Rio de Janeiro if, like, the local church establishes it up as a church thing. Like, in other places in America where you could find, like, big churches, not churches, crosses up and down the highway, you know, which could come under a different category. I think the context here more, if there was a clear public work and someone decides to worship it, or someone decides to, you know, do something, you know, set something up that it might seem as idolatrous, that doesn't cut it. Whereas if it would have been put up by, say, a religious authority,
can I just jump in one second?
Sure.
Because the situation given here, and I don't know the context, I don't know if there is any context given in the broader source, but, I mean, if the municipality of a Greek city is putting up a statue of Aphrodite, then it's for a religious purpose. I mean, the religion and government were not separate in those days. And oftentimes emperors or people who built cities or whatever would put up statues to the gods for the purpose of giving them God.
But look at source number 7, right? You had it in the bathhouse too.
Yeah, but it's presumably not of a bathhouse. I mean, like I said, I don't really
know the art, but again,
let's say it's a big fountain with Aphrodite in public square.
Yeah.
So it's technically in public, but it was put there by the governor or the emperor or whatever for the purpose of pleasing Aphrodite with a beautiful time.
Unless they would say it was possibly. I mean, I don't know. Well, it could be who would say that that might not cut it. I'll give another example of like where this came up. I was in Pesach for Good Friday. Was on a date, found myself in Via de the Rosa, that's what it's called, which is, you know, where you actually have the stations of the cross. It was a very surreal experience because, like, every 5 seconds you have, like, a group of people, like, going through it. And I asked afterwards my father's Rebbe, would that actually make the place forbidden? Because this is, I mean, we mentioned that you have certain places that are designated for a Avodah Zarah. There's a place that's designated for a Avodah Zarah. And they're actually, you know, that could be related, too, that if it becomes a place that's designated for a Avodah Zarah, then it would no longer be a public space. And I asked about that, and his answer was, as long as it's being used for the purpose, meaning at the days that they are actually going through the stations is a problem, the other days it isn't. Which I thought was an interesting answer.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't realize at the time, and I couldn't really get my way out that easily because I didn't know where I was going, because I don't live in Christian Quarter. So, really weird experience.
I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, the Via de la Rosa was built before there was, you know, any
Dolorosa.
Yeah, but now it's used at, this is the ritual. The ritual is to walk, you know, it hit all the stations.
Well, that sounds to me a much more clear case of a public place that 100% public being used for ritual purposes.
Yeah,
not a ritual thing.
Right. Which is why I brought up that example and my father's teacher's explanation. It was that when it's being used, so on those days when it's part of the Christian ritual to walk the stations, that's when it's a problem. Whereas any other time during the year, someone wants to walk the stations, like, you know, go ahead, but on certain days it has more significance than others.
So, right next to the Statue of Liberty, somebody opens up the Church of the Huddled Masses.
Yeah.
And it's their thing to constantly bow down to the Statue of Liberty as, you know, part of their thing. So, even though the Statue of Liberty is a public, is not private property.
Yeah.
So we're still allowed to,
you wouldn't be allowed to enter the church, but you'd be allowed to enter the Statue of Liberty.
And if they have services inside the statue?
Would it matter?
Okay.
At least I don't think it would matter.
According to your father's rabbi, you might not be able to hang around there while they're doing their service.
It's an interesting question if they would have the right to sort of take it over. I mean, if you really want to take it a few steps further, should you be allowed to ride the subway? Given, you know, early.
Well, right.
You've never been on the subway and hear, like, the various street creatures come in and start going off. Never?
Well, wait.
Street
sure.
They do it on street corners, but a subway, you could actually say, is, you know, more. Times Square is clearly, you know, public area, but they, like, as long. Is he actually, like, turning the subway into the church? Like, your actual, you know, E train car?
Wait a minute. Hang on. When the Arabs are doing their thing up atop the Kotel.
Separate question of Islam is considered a Vodazara.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Whole other issue. Aaron, take number 9, and this will help explain the distinction that we said earlier.
From Kfir Bar Abba, the name of Rabbi Yochanan, the Gentiles of southern land of Israel are not idolaters. They only continue the customs of their ancestors.
Yeah. This is a source of, I think, a lot of the distinctions that you find, like in the Rambam and elsewhere, that what the people are doing aren't really idolaters, they're just doing whatever their parents did.
What does that make it any better?
Kavanah, about the intent of what we do. Just like we would need kavanah, we would need intention to do mitzvot, you would need intention to do avodah zarah, at least for it to be idolatrous.
I think about Christmas today. Mm-hmm. 95% of, you know, I don't think any of us would have any kind of issue going to like a public, like a store where there's a Christmas tree, because it's so clearly not linked in any way to, like, they're just doing what their parents do.
Yeah, but in America right now that's true, but in a lot of other places in the world and in a lot of other times that's not true. People actually do have kavanah for their religion, whatever they are. Also, I think this supposes that there was some, like, pristine time in the history of, like, whatever they're saying, like, all Gentile religion, when people meant it and then their children now don't. I mean, I think that assumes a lot.
Also, keep in mind, you probably had no idea about Hinduism. No Eastern religion. No Zoroastrianism, you know.
Right. And also, I mean, I don't know when this statement was written necessarily, but, I mean, if it's in the Gemara,
yeah,
and
it's attributed to Rabbi Yochanan, who would be, you know, an Amora from Yerushalayim.
Okay. So then it's probably written at a time when, I don't know. Well, I
Rabbi Yochanan was from Israel, though. Keep that in mind too.
I do know that at the time generally that the Gemara was being written, Roman religion was like declining really fast, and even within Roman authors and literature, they were all complaining that no one believed in the gods anymore.
There you go.
You know, I mean, that's the void that Christianity filled, but I don't know if it's talking about Christians or about, like, Roman pagans.
Well, it just says Nukhrim, you know, which is more of, like, non-Jews.
Right. Maybe he's also referring to the fact that when the Christians were in Israel, they were much more devout than later on when Christianity came to the West.
Could there all be? From a historical perspective, you could be absolutely right. I'm sorry, what's that?
I said the Christians are sort of kind of gone too, like outside of, I guess besides Israel, there's probably also some patches of it around Italy from the Vatican, obviously, but like in America and like a lot of us in Europe, it's kind of a, you can kind of draw analogy for the goals of Christians in the same way that like.
More Christianity or Catholicism? Because Christianity is a whole lot of different things.
Probably more Catholicism.
And also, Catholics are doing really well in South America.
Yeah.
Really, really well. But the point is here, at least, is historically you could be absolutely right, but we'll see in a little bit how people will take that. You know, it explains Rambam's distinction as well. Why are we going to be a little bit more lenient outside of Israel than in Israel? And we'll see that the Divinary too kind of relies on this a little bit as well, that, you know, they were talking about one type of thing, but not our type of thing. You know, just as Yom might say, well, eggs in the time of the Gemara, the eggs in the size now, you know, the Avodah Zarah in the time of the Gemara isn't the Avodah Zarah of today. Avodah Zarah changed just as everything else.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the difference? You said that they hadn't addressed Hinduism or Zoroastrianism.
Well, the Yohanan wouldn't have, because Zoroastrianism was more Eastern, more out of Persia.
Why is there a difference? Why do we?
Because Zoroastrianism, Zoroastrianism, you really had dualism. You had, good God, bad God, a lot of that. Which you could just as easily say is idolatry, as, some might define. And people were very devout by that. And, there's a whole bunch of stuff written now by Dr. Yaakov Ellman about, Talmudic reactions to Sasanian culture. Hinduism is straight up polytheism.
Yeah.
Right? And, we'll assume that the Hindus believed in what they did, but Rav Yochanan would never have been exposed to that. Right? So, I think Jacob's answer from a historical context, certainly answers a great deal. From a halakhic perspective, this statement still endures, because not everyone takes, statements in historical context as just, well, here's an opinion that we may be able to rely on, certainly to try to, come up with a couple of leniencies.
You take it as a paradigm, saying Hindus outside of, whatever areas, whatever their holy cities are, assuming you talk about Christianity, where Christianity has some basis in Israel, you take this as a paradigm of Islam outside of their top five holy cities. Right.
That's an interesting way to put it. I don't read it as such, because it uses the term Nakhlim, which is very generic.
Right, okay.
If it said specifically about a particular religion, that would make a little more sense.
It would be intuitive to think about this for the Romans, for instance, where Israel has no religious significance to them.
I'm not sure I would read it that way, though.
Well, also, the translation says Israel, but the Hebrew just says La'aretz, and I realize that La'aretz usually means Israel, and they probably could have been clearer
than
its own La'aretz, but I don't know, maybe there's room to wiggle there.
The context, I don't think. That's a great point. From the context of the discussion, I don't think it means that.
Okay.
The context is... I happened to have read a few lines before.
Right. I think you were...
Never take my word for it. I mean, you see the Gemara in Kulin, everyone's free to... The reason why I keep putting in all this stuff with the Hebrew, with the citations, is, that people shouldn't take my word on it. Someone who comes to the Sunday class, asks me specifically, you mentioned this in this year, what's the source? And I searched for it, I couldn't find it. I eventually did. It was in Yerushalmi instead of a Babel. But, never take a rabbi's word for it when it says, oh, Gemara says, always ask for a source. Not in the sense that they're making it up. I'm sure every now and again someone is, but, you know, make sure that they're getting it right, or ask the question exactly like that, because from the small snippet, it's very easy to come to that conclusion based on this statement in context, which is about minim or non-Jews shafting, and, you know, distinction between them, and do you assume men are non-Jews and stuff like that. That's the context of the Gemara.
Turning back to Course in Classics, Ovid, Lineage, Addis, Lucius, the way they present the gods, you get the feeling that they don't even worship them so much as they're there.
Yeah, shrines, you have altars, you have offerings, didn't you? I believe you've got stuff in the Odyssey. You've got people making offerings for their gods.
They always made offerings
Are they really worshiping in the same sense that Jews worship or Islam?
I think it's the relationship that people have with the gods is definitely different, but it's also definitely a form of worshiping and, you know, making sacrifices or incantations or whatever in order to please or supplicate the gods.
Do we have a seat number 10? This is Ram number 7-6.
Images made by idolaters for artistic purposes are permitted to derive benefit from, but anything made for idolatry is prohibited. For example, any image found in the small town is prohibited because the status quo is that they're there to lead to worship, and it is. And if there is an established
precedent
that is for artistic purposes, it is allowed.
So there's a pattern here. So we said before that a Jew isn't allowed to make sculpture. But what if a non-Jew makes a sculpture? So according to Rambam, if it was made for aesthetic reasons, good to go. If it was made for idolatry, no good. And the Gemara gives a bunch of examples of certain things that have a chazakah, that you assume this was made for idolatrous purposes, small towns being one of them. But wherever you would have a case where there was a chazakah established, you know that this was made for artistic purposes, then it would be fine. Now that gets you to the next question again. So the stuff, you know, that's hanging there, were those, you know, acts of ritual, acts of worship themselves, or artistic representations? And for that, you would need to ask an art historian, and there's some other, you know, religious professors who like pontificating, no pun intended, about such things. That really one wasn't intended, believe me. And there would some say that, you know, the actual act of art is itself a form of worship, or it could just be a form of expression. Interesting question there. I'll leave that open. Dan, take this home with Miri, also from a vertebrae. This one's from the beginning, on 2A.
Okay. The same. Mitzad goyim shabachut la'aretz lo hutar ela lifnei ha'id. Aval yom ha'id atmo atzo. And thus, from the perspective of non-Jews outside of Israel, they're only permitted before the holidays, but not for the holiday itself. Vahare min ha'gaheter ach b'yom ha'id hu. When we talk Ikar Hadvarim
Akar. Yeah.
Akar Hadvarim Mira Leish.
Actually, it could be Ikar Hadvarim. Yeah, that might make more sense, but there should be a Yud. Anyway, my head's up.
Mira Leish Hadvarim Elu, Kulan Lo Nemru Ella El Ode Ha Lilim Betoyo Sehem, Vispal Mehem, Abba Bismanim Halalu Mutar Lagan. Right. And behold, the practice is to be permissive even on the day of the holidays, and because of this, they uprooted the word.
I read it as Akar, as opposed to Ikar, because there was no Yud there, but it's
Ikar Akar
nearly. Yeah, no, I think Ikar actually makes a little more sense. Ikar Akar nearly, the main point, it seems to me, is that, yeah, continue.
It seems to me that these things are only said regarding worshiping the other gods, their images, and their statues, but for these holidays, it's permitted altogether. No way. That's not what he means, is it?
Dismanim halalu mutar legamre. That much I didn't mess up.
No, but this is the stuff people take all out of context, right?
Oh, and other things, too. What people attribute to the Megiri is that it's only a hodat elohim. It's only when you worship the gods, but they don't have laws. But rather, if they have laws, as long as there's some legal-based religion, they're okay. That's how... I'm telling you what I've heard.
No.
You have to nod in the ear here. You see that there's a bit of... you see a bit like why this could be a contradiction, but you also see, you know, the need for it. Practically speaking, if you were a Jew living in Europe, you had to do business with non-Jews. So, you know, there are two ways when you see people are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. One way is to say everyone is wrong. What many Ashkenazi medieval authorities said, you know, especially say the Baal Leh Tosafot, was this is what the Gemara says, this is what the popular practice is, what is the basis for what everyone is doing, right? And, you know, you kind of see, well, this is what people are doing, we see there's a need for it, what is the, you know, after the fact justification for it? And his take is here that, well, maybe the days are altogether permitted, which is interesting because we saw later on he said not only is Christianity considered a avodah zarah, but you can't even do business with them on Sundays. How do you resolve it? I'm not going to even attempt now. Meiri writes a whole lot of stuff in avodah zarah, and I recommend people follow it. But realize that when people just say with a blanket statement, Meiri said that Christianity is an avodah zarah, not so simple. But you see why... you know, he would have a need to do so just for basic financial reasons. You find this come up a lot in the discussions on Stam Yena, dealing with non-Jewish wine, drinking with non-Jews, all of that stuff that at the time people absolutely had to do. You know, and we kind of, Jacob Katz was one of the people who wrote on the subject that I believe Halbert Hall in his article is defending, you know, wrote several books along these lines of what was, you know, Shabbos for you, case studies and all of its flexibility, tradition in Christ, like how did people handle dealing with modernity and halakha evolving in response to, you know, the things that they were, you know, people really needed to do to survive. So, at the end of the day, the intent of this class was really for people to get a little more confused than they would have otherwise. But the reason why is that it is important to recognize, you know, before, you know, it's very easy to be a fundamentalist about stuff and to say, well, this is a avodah zarah, and therefore we need to destroy it. And we can understand in a bit of the certainly from the biblical statements in the Hayyei Al Yahweh and the severity, what would lead people to that conclusion. Halakha lamaase, in practice, you actually have to know a lot more of what you're talking about. And that means not knowing not just a lot more about halakha, you need to know a lot more about avodah zarah. So, like, when someone asked me a question about a particular statue, I said, well, it really depends, like, could you describe the statue for me? And it was a Buddhist statue. Depending on the design of the Buddhist statue, on the traditions, in one tradition, I would say a statue would be a bodhisattva, because in that tradition, they actually pray to the statue. In another tradition, they don't pray to the statue, but the statue is used as a focal point of concentration. Huge difference between them, because in one you're worshiping, and the other one you're not. Right, so you want to tell me a Buddha statue? Well, you have to know a little bit about it in order to make an intelligent decision. So it's easy, and it's interesting because normally you say like tone it down, but even Rambam says, you know, when you have the power to do so, you know, go up and destroy it.
Would you want to be the rabbi who says it's okay to go into this Buddhist temple under these circumstances and have your words taken out of context saying, yes, it's okay to go to Buddhist temple?
At this point, well, assuming like I would actually write some of the stuff in, you know, detail, I mean, I wouldn't write much about Buddhism because, you know, I don't know as much to write, like, until I can start going through stuff in Sanskrit, which I have no intention of doing.
Right.
But otherwise, let's say I would have been, absolutely. Because the truth is, especially with matters of avodah zarah, people are going to take stuff in or out of context no matter what.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the people who don't care about looking at sources, it doesn't matter. For the people who say, well, let's look at the original source, then you'll put in the effort. I mean, look at Meiri. Meiri has this reputation as being, oh, Christianity's not a avodah zarah. Now, did he actually say that anyplace? To my knowledge, no. It's something that people have made from inference, and something, I think it's how people have taken him. I have not seen it. If someone can show me a source where he says very explicitly, followers of Jesus are not worshiping the avodah zarah, which again would contradict what he said on, you know, on page 8 in his comment. Well, not page 8, but like his commentary on Zaf in the avodah zarah. Like, you really have to spend a lot of time in the Meiri to parse it out, and all, you know, not so simple. So if I would do it, I'd be incredibly careful. But even as careful as you are, people ignore what you write. But if you're in constant fear of that, maybe you wouldn't have written anything. Yeah.
Well, the reverse direction.
Yeah.
You take something that's holy.
Yeah.
And apply it to something that isn't. For example, you have a song and you use the Torah trump to write the melody on.
Okay.
Is that permissible? Not permissible?
For the tune? Interesting question. I have to think about that. Nothing's coming to mind. Like, if I take the, you know, trope and turn that into a rock song somehow. Yeah, I don't know offhand why that would be a problem. There are issues of taking, certainly, the words for decorative purposes. You can't make certain decorations out of pseudonym.
Well, wait a minute. Hang on.
Yeah.
Let's go to your and my favorite topic.
Yeah.
You take a Christian rock song.
Yeah.
And you co-opt it and make a Jewish song parody out of it in the attempt to take something profane and make it holy.
Right.
You're selling records. You're making money. You're probably violating copyright.
Well, aside from the copyright thing, you've got this statement of, you know, Amy Gudmikabel Tuma, that a tune doesn't accept impurities, which we discussed here before.
Yeah,
I think it's possible to read a Rabbi Yosef's problem as you're just listening to the music and getting benefit from it as it's actually being used for worship. Whereas you might also be able to read it as, well, what you're doing is you're taking something that would otherwise be designated for Bodhisattva and using it a little more popular. Like Amazing Grace and Ave Maria, yes, you know, they're spiritual songs, but at this point you can also say they're part of pop culture. I don't know where you would draw the line. You could argue that as soon as someone sings it on American Idol, it's no longer designated for worship. It's a hypothetical thing there. Like, you know, that's a good sign of like where, all right, this is beyond pure worship and it's now pop culture.
Wow.
Well, the thing that, like, as Ephraim was saying about the Christmas tree and stuff like that, where for a lot of people it's not it doesn't have any religious significance or holiness, but for a lot of people it does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you deal with a thing like that?
Yeah.
In other words, it kind of happened now.
Yeah.
Depending on where you are or when you are.
Well, the cross was another great example. I mean, you know, for majority of people, the cross would be a religious symbol that, you know, is worth, you know, for worshiping. For certain avant-garde artists, it's something that, you know, elephants are supposed to defecate on. If anyone remembers that big scandal from Giuliani these days. Yeah. Good, yeah, fun stuff. Anyway, so hope there's at least, you know, if it wasn't just confusing, I hope at least you understand the different parameters or know, have some idea of what are the questions to ask when these ideas come up. Because when you can ask better questions, obviously you're going to get better answers. You just say, you know, this is what others are, and someone has no idea what you're talking about. Also, you're going to get a mock-near answer by saying no. Because, you know, understandably, something for a vote is already, you want to be straight. You really want to get, you know, an in-depth, serious answer, you know, it pays to know what else to ask. Yeah.
That's sort of okay.
Well, reading books is a whole other issue because some of the issues with it is being the safer chitsonim, help you describe that. But on the other hand, if you don't know it, you can't ask in what the voters are. No, it's not your job. Like, you know, someone has to. It's okay for you, but not for you type thing. When you're talking about Easterim, I could say it's bad advice, like don't read it, but like if in order for me to say it's usher, right, it's really hard for me to say, well, it's, you know, mutter for me to do it, but it's usher for you. You know, there are a few places you can have some subjectivity, but I don't think this is one of them.
Cool.
All right.